Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Date a Scientist? I am joined today by Nikolai Bashlikov. Hi, Nikolai. How are you doing?
Hi, Wendy. All good. Thank you very much. Glad good. To see you.
You too. I do like to ask a second time, like, actually, how are you? Because everything's, apart from the sun being out, everything's a bit crap.
The weather's great. I have a good mood. So, like, other than financial and political issues, like, everything else.
Do you know what? I started this podcast. Well. I started recording the podcast in, what, August last year? So it's been nearly a year. I've nearly done 50, whatever, with his late 40s. And I started by saying that, asking that question, hoping that by the time we got here, I wouldn't have to ask it anymore, but it just keeps getting worse and worse.
Oh, yeah, unfortunately.
So let's start off with the first question. What's your favorite piece of tech ever?
It's a good question. So that's actually changing over time. So, like, when I think I started being interested in data science, I was really fond of, like, computer vision and all these things they were doing with, like, automated vehicles and stuff like that. Then, like, the interest was switching quite a lot. I was quite fond of medical breakthroughs using machine learning and data science. And lately I was kind of engaged in like a new thing. It's not like as much of machine learning. It's about, like, homomorphic encryption and how can we make the data and processing the data more private in a way. So that's a cool piece of tech which is just evolved, like, a decade ago. And it just enables you to kind of do processing of data without actually seeing what you're handling. So it's kind of quite a good application in medical science when you need to kind of process the data without actually seeing what is underneath the data.
Wow. So, yeah. That is a good one. I've never heard of that. Thanks for bringing it to my attention. I love it that you're like, it's new. It's been in the last decade.
Yeah. The latest release was just, like, probably a couple of months ago, something like that. So, okay. Yeah, that's, like, really evolving quite fast.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for that. So you're head of data science at the moment. Can you talk me through your data science journey, how you got into it?
So it was a journey, I would say. So I started, like, I had some backgrounds in order to kind of pursue this career, but I haven't started with this career initially. So I graduated with a computer science degree, but then I just went for a consulting career, which I found amazing because you have a great overview of everything and everywhere, and you could be engaged in all different industries. But sometime later on, a friend of mine just brought up the topic that, hey, like, that's, and that was around 2014, 15-ish. And that was kind of the boom of data science, machine learning, and all these fancy words. And he was just, hey, let's go to some lecture in one of the tech companies around our city. And that was really great. And I thought, that's something definitely I'm missing out. So that all started over there. And with my friend, we just did a couple of pet projects, motivated by some of the papers, of the recent papers of the time. And it started kind of rolling on. I switched the department within the consulting, within EY, from more, like, industry-oriented to financial-oriented, because there is more data in finance, and that's where I could apply some of the algorithms I kind of started learning about. And I felt that it's a good kind of mixture of my abilities, my knowledge, and the business and the needs of the business. So I started from simple, like, risk models. That was financial team, and we were doing a lot of credit risk modeling for banks, you know, like, whenever anyone is underlying a loan or, like, giving you some money, it's usually not for free, and that depends on the kind of level of risk that you kind of inherit. And to kind of determine it, you need some methods, and it was heavily based on some very, like, straightforward, like, linear logistic regressions. And that was the moment where we just thought, hey, let's probably do something more sophisticated in there, because we have the skills, we have the knowledge, and here we have the new kind of tool set to do that. That kind of started over there. I kind of organized a small group first of like machine learning enthusiasts within within EY. And we were kind of doing those workshops all together, having those exchange of ideas and approaches and algorithms, started learning all Python and all this tech around that. And at some point I just went to our partner who was leading the whole financial group and just told him, hey, this is a great piece of tech. We can just apply it and we can sell it together with you to two different clients, and we can do like everything from, I don't know, customer clustering, predicting financial returns, estimating portfolios of the clients. And he just said, yeah.
I bet they love you.
No, that was, that actually was quite a fascinating time at that point, because I was like, I was still young. And everything was just so like evolving so fast that it was just inspiring me a lot. So yeah, that was the beginning of the journey. Some years later, I just decided to go. So yeah, I had my kind of, how to say, it always goes like in the waves. So first you're like super excited, then you just understand how how stupid you are in this subject, how painful it is to kind of to present and build some stuff, and understanding that you just know like 10% of the stuff.
The learning wave, yes, definitely. Especially in the consultancy as well, I guess. Like, because if you're working for an normal company, you're just going up in your learning wave. And with a consultancy, you've got new clients, new projects, different roles, different people to work with. It must be quite, I mean, a massive learning curve, but also thrown in at the deep end, learning really quickly, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the industries are different. So it's not only financial. We just started rolling it out to like oil and gas or metals and mining. And that was like very, like, it was quite challenging thing. And like initially you thought that, yeah, machine learning is a holy grail. I can just solve everything with that. And then you understand that, yeah, that's basically not the case. And you need to prove that your solution would be better than that particular person, mechanics at an oil and gas company who just is in the industry for 45 years and he knows much better than you are.
Yeah.
And like, and that's where like, the challenge comes, just selling and explaining why this machine learning model predicted that particular outcome and not another one, explaining how it works, like building the confidence around the subject and trying to kind of take everyone on board, all those like people involved in the processes.
I think that shows you what you've just said, that the business part of data science, understanding the business is really important. And we've discussed this previously on the podcast. It's not just about being technical and being able to work out those statistics, build the models. It's about understanding how business works as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the like very important parts. So like it's much more beneficial to kind of be closer to the business rather than just going deep into the underlying tech, because like, and there are like different paths. Obviously there is a path with like data science research, machine learning research, and those are great minds, great people who are just developing new tools, writing out the libraries, researching on the new ways of optimizing like algorithms and so on and so forth, but they are very like not very related to the business issues itself. And the big part of data science is kind of to build that bridge between the business problem that you're trying to solve and what is actually the pain with the business and the actual algorithm and machine learning kind of approach. And that's usually the hardest part, actually, to kind of build that bridge, because everything else is just like, you know, that funny word that like any machine learning model is just three lines of code. You just do model, then you do predict, like fit, and then predict, like those three lines of code, and you can actually train quite a sophisticated
model. Easy. All done.
Like, yeah, all done. Three lines of code, and everyone could ask, what are the machine learning scientists are just doing it all. It's just so simple. And the problem is that, yeah, you just need to kind of to marry all the things with this business problem, collect all the necessary data, understand how it works, and like understand the underlying business processes, because without that, you can just easily train on some biased data or just create some like useless algorithm which
just doing something but not what you want it to do. It's just doing something.
Yeah.
So have you come across any challenges in your career?
That's actually, yeah, so like the one I've mentioned probably would be probably like one of the most kind of a serious hits that I got is that, yeah, machine learning is not a holy grail. And then when I was studying, I was quite overselling it to myself, to everyone else around me. And then I had to be kind of to respond, to kind of be accountable for the results. And then that when the results were not that fascinating as you were kind of upselling them, then there is a challenge and you need to understand, hey, why is that great tech is not working the way you thought it would work? And the fine example was when I was building within EY, we had a project for one of the credit risk companies. So they had a problem with, so they were collecting and buying the portfolios of overdue debt. So basically one bank is just lending out a lot of money, then there were some customers who are not paying, so they're kind of getting rid of those assets for some credit risk companies who are just trying to collect the debt or just to oversell it or do something with that. So there was a huge business in just buying those portfolios of overdue debt. And to buy that portfolio, you need to understand how much money does that portfolio of customers and their loans cost. Mm-hmm. And what you have initially is just a bunch of variables like the social demographic of the person who had the loan, like the size of the loan and so on and so forth, like, I don't know, hundreds of metrics and from different sources. And the question is, how much would you get money from that particular customer in like 5 years time or 3 years time, whatever the LTV is? And the problem was that the business is very like kind of old school. They're not very used to it. So like the way they were looking into the data is that, hey, this portfolio from this bank looks pretty much similar to the one that we had processed 5 years ago. So we would assume that the returns would be pretty much the same. Right. So when I came and just discussed that, hey guys, yeah, we can do that. Like, and they had a huge department of just, they were doing manual work with comparing line by line those data sets. Yeah, that's incredible. And yeah, when like a couple of like me and a couple of other my coworkers just came and said, yeah, hey guys, we can just optimize it all and just build machine learning model in a couple of months. They just say, yeah, like, why not try it out? And like after 2 months, we just realized that we are just starting collecting the pure good data. And the first pain point was that, yeah, like the problem is with the data that's like very on the it's quite obvious, yeah, and you would have the problem with the data anyway. So yeah, we were just very optimistic about the dates. We were very optimistic about how much impact that would like give us, because like with bad data, you would have bad results, obviously. So it all started out like very slaggy. We need to kind of explain how this machinery works for the CEO and CFO of the company. And they were not very data-driven.
So they rarely are they?
So at some point it was so embarrassing that we had to kind of explain how the machine learning model works with just drawing the decision trees of the random forest and sticking it on the whiteboard, just explaining, so we're averaging the results of those like bunch of hundreds of trees. So usually that is how it works. So like you have those features on each of those decision points, And that's how we're kind of optimizing the algorithm so that gives you a good result. And that was the point when they finally kind of embraced how that works. We obviously had a lot of work, like engineering was like, I don't know, like 10% of time, like, I don't know, 50% of time was kind of collecting the pure data, and yeah, the rest 40% was just explaining how everything works, why this particular feature is of any relevance at all, and how this particular feature impacts the final outcome. So there was a lot of like drawings, beautiful presentations, words around that. So like that was purely a very like fascinating time for me when I understood that, yeah, it's actually not that much about engineering. That is much more about, first of all, data engineering, and second of all, bringing the stakeholders on the board with what you're doing and explaining why like that particular feature is more important than another feature, which they thought for some random reason should work fine and would be the decision in that particular point. So like in my case, that would be probably the most challenging part of just building up that bridge of and ensuring that everyone is on the same page.
Do you think that's getting easier as time goes on? Now more people are kind of understanding what data is bringing to the company.
Yeah, that's actually quite amazing to oversee. And even in my current company, where I'm like I'm just left it, I'm in transition to another tech company. The great thing that I can see is that it evolves very fast. So when I started at a ride-hailing company, like barely anyone could just... So like the most often request that I was receiving as a head of data science was, hey, could you upload this CSV with like 100 rows of our customers and just some random data? I was like, that should not definitely work like that. So, and actually I oversaw how it was evolving. So I have brought the self-service tools with where people could start exploring the data themselves. I brought up like all those data marts and data cubes to wrangle the data, define the metrics so that like everyone computes the same thing in the same way. And it started actually, I started to oversee, like for me, the key metric was the number of requests per week, the right. number of stupid ad hoc requests per week that a child could kind of derive from the data. And that drastically started to kind of decline. And that's really great because the company overall started to be more data-driven. Business and leadership are just required from the employers or like teammates to kind of put on the table already data validated decisions. So in like not a single decision would go through being approved without any data underlying it. And everyone started kind of using those tools and understanding that it's not that much of a rocket science to kind mm-hmm. of do the pivot, aggregate the data, collect it for some period of time. So that there are not that many like things that you kind of, as a overall, you kind of need, you just learn several kind of aggregation functions and that would cover 80% of your requests.
Yeah.
And the data science team just helps with another 20% where there is actually some sophisticated research or analysis or model to be involved in. So that's really great. And I can see that it's not only in our company that this happens. I can see like in some job descriptions, it quite often the case that it is required for you to kind of be proficient in SQL as a non-data person to yep. be acquainted with some business intelligent tools like Looker, Tableau, and so on and so forth, because everyone is starting using them. And if you don't use them, that is kind of a disadvantage for you.
Yeah.
So I definitely see that, yeah, it's evolving quite fast. And that's really great to see because like now data scientists can kind of specialize more in some more kind of, you know, like the pyramid of like requests and pyramid.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, it'd be much more niche and interesting for you guys, right?
yeah.
So this podcast, as you know, is aimed at people who are looking to get into data science, either through academia or if they're in a position now pivoting into data science from their current role. Have you got any tips for those people that wanted to get into data science? How can, look, it's really, really hard for somebody to find an entry-level data science role at the moment. And it would be really helpful if you had any tips or insight as to how people could get on that first rung of the ladder.
Yeah, that's actually quite a good point for a discussion for another kind of the whole lecture on that.
Good.
What I can see from my experience, that would be a little bit of how to say advertisement.
Go for it.
So the way I see it works quite well. I'm currently lecturing machine learning and data science at some online platform. It's called Yandex Practicum, which is quite good. So they have a very like cool program, and there are a bunch of them, obviously, but like the one I know and I can kind of relate to is like this Practicum by Yandex. And they kind of have the very solid course with a lot of practical exercises. And the important thing is that you always can like practice on very on real examples of the data, which were prepared by like data scientists, which were taken from like real industry examples. And you are helped with people from around the industry, like the real practitioners. So that is really great. And the important thing is that, yeah, once you get the like basics of just like the learning fundamentals of like different algorithms, classification, regression, how you can tackle with the different types of data, texts, categorical features, numerical features, and so on and so forth, then it's very important to start as early as possible of just doing some pet projects or like involving in those real kind of cases, solving them together with your teammates and so on and so forth. And what I can see from the cohorts that I'm teaching is that like 80 to 90% of students who are just completing those like projects, real projects, they can actually update their LinkedIn straight away. And relating to a particular business problem when they're describing the case. And 80 to 90% of them are finding the job within 3 months. And it's obviously an entry job, but I see that, yeah, the focus on kind of practice a lot and trying. So like the advice I would never give to anyone is just, hey, go like learn 5 years, start with algebra, then linear algebra, then functional analysis, and only then just start doing some machine learning, and only then just start looking for a job. No, that's not an approach I would like. That's not a working approach. So the working approach would be to learn something new, start applying it straight away, build on top of that some bit of the theory, the next kind of brick, apply it straight away, and so on and so forth. So there is no need of just, obviously there is an imposter syndrome that every one of us.
Absolutely.
Has,
yeah.
But so, you don't know something in particular.
Yeah. So what you're saying is great, because whenever I learn something, I forget it. So what you're saying is learn it, put it into practice, then learn something else and put that on top of it. And yeah, that's really, really, really good advice. What was the name of the place that you're lecturing at?
It's Practicum by Yandex. Okay. I can share it later on.
We'll put it in the show notes. So I've not heard of them, but yeah, that sounds really good. And that's a really good turnaround of people getting roles within 3 months. So yeah, thanks for that. Really good. Because see, look, as a recruiter, I tend to get the higher level roles. I don't really get entry level roles for data science. So when people come to me and ask them for me, I'm like, no, I can't help you. Listen to my podcast. And there's lots of people coming to me and asking me. So that's really, really helpful. Thanks very much. Thank you. So what do you think data science is going to look like in the future?
As usual, that's quite interesting to kind of forecast.
Use your predictions.
Yeah, my predictions. I would have to kind of reiterate on that podcast when it's live 10 years after that.
Earn some great money from doing that. Yes, it's really difficult. Some people have said that it's going to go a lot of automation, so there'll be a lot less data science. Some people have mentioned that, you know, everything used to come under the data science umbrella, as we were talking about earlier, the data engineering, and now there are so many different roles that it could go that way. It's just, yeah, there's lots of things that could happen, isn't there?
Yeah, I think like in terms of data science, definitely you would go for some specialization much more than we have now. I would definitely say that, as I've just described you on my simple example of my company working in, that actually data science tools are being embedded in the like in the job descriptions already of like all different roles, starting from financial analysts, operation executive, sales manager, and so on and so forth, because you need to kind of understand basically you need to compute and estimate the effect of your work. And the only way to do that right is just to do it yourself. So that's where like you need SQL, you need Tableau, you need Looker, or whatever like data analysis tools you have at hand, like starting even with like Excel or stuff like that.
Yeah.
So like data analysis would be embedded in the roles of like different people. And that would be something like, I don't know, like I'm so old that I remember the job description where it was required, like proficiency in computer is good, like with...
right. So many words per minute.
yeah, like you should be proficient in Microsoft Office and like Excel and so on. So I would see that like data analysis, data science would be embedded in the roles as it was, as like Microsoft Office was embedded like 20 years ago into job descriptions. In terms of automation, definitely, like everything is being automated, and the important role would be of a data engineer to bring all the pipelines together. So that that is a very specific specialization, and there is a lot of to do in there, and that would be evolving much further. In terms of machine learning, I think machine learning itself would merge with software engineering, and it already is merging within like Facebook and Google. It's already kind of starting to merge. So they don't have machine learners, they have machine learning software engineers.
Okay.
So in this case, yeah, it would be much more specialized with data engineering pipeline, with the machine learning like specialty, all the like data analysis and visualization tools would be embedded in the like your everyday tools as in any role, because you can't live without it. So yeah, and definitely it will not die out, because like everyone just understands that it's super important to understand how kind of how the business performs. And
so the platforms that you're working on will have the data science built in, and it will just be an everyday, a normal everyday.
Yeah, pretty much. What I can see is that they all build a very like plug and go option. So it's very low like maintenance, like it's cost. Their selling point. The less maintenance, the better it is. Yeah, if a CEO can just plug it in and just play around, that's great. If you need 10 engineers to kind of integrate it, that's not the solution that a company will go for. So everything, is just automated. Everything has very great UI and user experience, and everything is just starting to be this plug and go thing where you just minimize the code.
Makes perfect sense. What's your favorite project that you've ever done? And this could be one that you've worked on, or it could be something that you've done in your spare time, or what's the most fun project you've done?
So I enjoyed a lot, like one like recent project within like marketplace efficiency within my ride-hailing company. So that it was basically to understand, and it was like, it was 50-50. It was 50% like data science, 50% machine learning. And actually that's a great combination. It's not like purely engineering and purely data science. And the cool thing about the project is that it was like kind of The setup was interesting. So it's a marketplace where you have like riders, you have customers, and you're looking into kind of making the customers happier, whereas not like hurting a lot of the drivers. And so the idea was like, how can we measure the like customers' retention if depending on the number of drivers on the platform? So the number of drivers impacts the waiting time for the customer. So if the waiting time for the customer is too high, then the customer will just churn. And it was quite like overall a sophisticated like concept. Like it's quite straightforward, but it was quite interesting to understand whether there is a real kind of effect on the data with this kind of setup. And the goal of the project was basically, yeah, just let's have like a model which would just tell us like what should be the supply for a particular, I don't know, hour or place in the city, so that we can optimize for the conversion from like for the customers, so that more customers enjoy their rides. And the idea was that we started analyzing it and understood that there is a really very strong correlation between the supply of the cars and the customer kind of participation. And we started kind of modeling it and proposing, hey, like let's try to kind of forecast that particular, like let's bring on the platform that amount of drivers so that we have optimized the waiting time for the customers, and we are improving the churn, decreasing the churn and improving the kind of revenues at the end of the day. And the cool project of that was that it is super straightforward to communicate to the stakeholders. So it's based on the very simple principles. And the idea is that it kind of drives a lot the revenues, because like you are managing the whole marketplace, and that kind of generate, that's in the core of your business. So it's very kind of impactful in terms of the outcomes. It's also very transparent for the stakeholders that, hey, what you're building is quite important for us, and that's why, keep on going. And also I liked it a lot because you can see the effect straight away in the impact. It's not that easy to kind of measure it correctly, because once you're kind of starting deploying the model and like there is a kind of network effect that you can't kind of isolate everyone from everyone. So like it starts impacting itself, but overall, overall there was like a positive impact, at least on the historical data before and after. So you can't just measure it at the same time. AB is a classic example. It's a bit more complex in that case. That one was quite interesting in terms of the project, because it was kind of clear for you how to solve it, clear for the stakeholders. It's a bit more techy in terms of how you would just collect correct data, how you would aggregate it, and what should be a simple model so that you can explain it to the like stakeholders. And the impact is quite substantial. So it's kind of those tiny projects, tiny percentage of projects, which are very visible,
yeah,
and easily translatable for like particular business effect and for the final stakeholders, because like usually it's very kind of digging the grounds.
You would be surprised how many people's favorite projects are involving customers and wanting to improve the business for the customer. I think when I thought of this question, I was thinking back to my recruitment when I speak to candidates, and you know, what kind of projects have you been working on? And it's, you know, it's really interesting to hear. And there was some projects that somebody was doing. So disabled people, when they can't speak, are using blinking to speak, right? And they were improving that. So it would be eye movements would be much better, because blinking, you need to blink you can't stop yourself from blinking sometimes, so it'd be much more effective. And there was somebody else that was doing like foot massage, like there were so many different things, and it's blown my mind how many, like, everybody, like, in, who I speak to in data science is a good person and they want to just make things better. Like, do you know what I mean? It's really lovely to hear. I was just jabbering on there.
No, that's absolutely true. Whenever you have, like, impact on the customers themselves, that's, yeah, like, so rewarding when you can see how you impacted, how you made their life better. So it's definitely one of the greatest kind of rewards for your work.
I suppose that goes with kind of any role. Like, if somebody reached out to me and said that the podcast is brilliant and they love it, I'm like, oh my god, that's the best feeling. Or if I've got somebody a job that they really want, or I've coached somebody and they've got their ideal position. Yeah, you're right. It's everything. It's like making people happy and watching them succeed, like, makes my life. It's so good.
Yeah, that's true.
So you mentioned bias earlier. Let's talk a little bit about that in the data. Do you think that we're ever going to have unbiased data? What's the best way to get it?
That's a very kind of difficult question.
Obviously
the models are as biased as the underlying data is, and like human beings are very biased historically.
And always will be. Look, well, no matter how much you work on yourself, you're still going to have some unconscious bias, as we heard in an episode of my podcast the other day. Sorry to interrupt.
That's absolutely right. So, like, even though, like, we're working on that in that direction, and that's really great, you would always still have some unconscious bias, and you would not always be able to identify it easily. And that's, like, the big problem as well. What I was saying is that, the model would be as biased as the underlying data is. And we can see that, it's actually quite biased. So we can't, like, you can try to kind of purify the data, but then it's kind of a tricky way of doing things as well, because you're kind of modifying it with your own bias, so that's creating even more bias. There are some process-oriented approaches and, like, some, like, modeling approaches, so to say. So in general, the problem is that the bias comes not only from the data underlying, but also from, like, the people working on the data. So, like, as you know, like, like the obvious example that only, like, I don't know, 12% of, I just read it a couple of hours before, that only 12% of machine learning researchers are actually female, and that already creates a bias towards male kind of
12%. Wow.
12, yeah. At Facebook, it's like 15%, 10% at Google, and that's actually really kind of where the bias comes from. It's not only from the data, but also from the people who are working on that,
sure,
on the data. So, like, one obvious kind of where the companies are going towards is just unbiasing the hiring process, so that you kind of make it more and more diverse, not only in terms of the gender, but obviously all sorts of bias, also like educational bias and like racial and age and so on and so forth. So that's very important, like, from the beginning, like, when you are hiring, your hiring process should be very unbiased, and that should be very, like, representative of all the groups, so that they all can contribute to the modeling going forward. So another point is, that problem is, like, I don't know, there is a book, I think, called World Designed by Man or something. I think you've read it. It is quite popular. And they have, like, plenty of great examples of why this doesn't, like, work as it's supposed to be. For example, like, in car manufacturing, all the designers, engineers, and people who are designing the car are male. mostly. And that's why the safety system for women in the car is like 40 or 50% less effective than for men. Because like even the test body that they are testing in the cars is designed from the specifics of a average male.
I think it was Kriti Dinera who came on my podcast a long time ago. She mentioned this, and they like the crash test dummies were all men. And they only brought women in recently. And even then they only put them in the passenger seat. Like, they're so bad.
So that's one side of the question. Who designed the system? And the second side of the question is the data. With the data, it's a bit more like kind of like it's not like that straightforward, but at least you know like how, like it's like, to my understanding, it's a bit probably easier to approach, because when you have a ready-made model, you already can analyze it like on some biases. You can just cut your data into like different chunks and see how it performs on different particular data sets, and understand whether there is a particular bias. You can analyze your features. So for me, as a like more of an engineer, like at least I can see how to fix that. In terms of the processes in hiring, it's like it's just embedded, and it's a very long way. Like how the like, and it's great that we're going this way, but that's like, it will not happen just at once. But yeah, so like summing up, there is at my, in my understanding, is like that, like in terms of organizational way and how we and who we hire, and in terms of the data, which is more manageable, you can understand the bias while just analyzing the performance of your model in different sets and different kind of slices of the data, and understanding which are the features which impact and in what way they impact. So if you have a feature of a gender, and you can see that, and usually those kind of features are like removed straight away, because like there is a lot of problems with them in terms of like bias generation. But if you can see that some feature has a very strong kind of bias to one on the other side, you already can just examine it a bit more and try to kind of probably generate more positive examples or negative examples with that feature in your data set. With generating data, like with generating examples, you can do some synthetic generating examples if the data is underpresent in your data set, or you can just try accumulating more data from more diverse data sources and so on and so forth. So at least it's kind of manageable. The problem is that there are some subtle, as you discussed, there are some biases that are unconscious and that are not that easily kind of traced. So yeah, that is a very kind of subtle topic, and
not for now. I think I definitely so look, I think the new generation of people coming, Gen Z, they are fantastic at like putting bias to bed, I think, being very open and learning and teaching and just letting everybody be themselves. So I think it's going to be amazing to see how that data changes from like the original historic data, which will be white male of a certain age, to all of the genders, all of the races, all socioeconomic backgrounds. It would be it'd be really interesting to see that. And I think we're getting there slowly now, but I think as soon as the new generation are like in the boardroom, it's gonna go really quickly. I think it's gonna just slowly roller coaster, and it's gonna go poof. And I can't wait to see that happen. I cannot wait.
Absolutely.
So okay, there are too many billionaires in this world. Okay, I don't think there should be any. Do you think that one of them or a few of them are building an evil supervillain? And if they are, how will we stop them? And what should the punishment be?
Yeah.
So far. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that these questions, tricky ones. In general, I'm kind of like, it's quite obvious to say that, humankind so far was doing quite well in just managing some critical situations in their history, and we're still all alive, and humankind is just evolving itself. So I'm kind of have some trust in terms of like self-regulatory kind of mechanisms within the societies, so that if something just goes particularly very wrong, it should be kind of self-healed in like probably not very fast, but like hopefully in like a decade eventually. Or two. So if we eventually that should be quite good. So we like deal with so many crazy things.
I mean, you're right, aren't you? I mean, look at the last couple of years. We'll get something thrown at us. We'll either sort it out or learn to live with it.
Yeah. Hopefully the first one, but
hopefully the first one, please. Oh, bless you. Well, look, thank you so much for coming on. Before we go, is there anything that you would like to plug or talk about?
Yeah, I would just give some encouragement to the students or like early practitioners of this subject, which is like really be persistent. And the topic is like every year I'm reading the news that the next 10 years, the data science will just boom and evolve and so on and so forth. And every year I can see that it's actually booming and evolving. And that keeps on kind of motivating me of just working harder and harder in this direction, because I can see that it doesn't seem to fade out. When it started all over, I heard that, like in 2 years' time, we will develop an algorithm which would write the code itself. Some AI would just generate the code for us, so we would never need to learn coding at all. But like, it's never happened. You kind of keep on going and developing great things, and it just keeps on kind of as a snowball increasing in terms of complexity.
And look, there's going to be new coding that's coming out. Somebody mentioned Jai code the other day, and there's going to be, people are going to make the automation easier, so even the automating machine, the automating AI will need updating
human being.
Right.
So human being will not kind of get out of the of this equation hopefully anytime like in the nearest 50 years at least. But it definitely worth just keep on trying and seeing how everything works out yourself, and just keeping doing things and evolving in that direction.
Perfect. Nikolai, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a really good chat. I will, thank you. It's really good. There's, just going to let everybody know, there's only a few episodes left of Would You Data Scientist for this season. I'm going to give it a little rest so everybody can catch up. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
I really blessed the idea that I was one of the last ones to hop in the train.
Thanks, Nikolai. You take care.
Thanks a lot, Wendy, and have a nice day.